Okay, we're going to start in a few minutes. We're just waiting for some of the members of the review team to join us. What we're going to do now is have a detailed report from the sub-team who are looking at the issue of who is policy and trying to identify what that policy is, where it's recorded, what are the obligations and how are the obligations to be overseen. And we have Kathy Kleiman and James Bladel giving a presentation on that. I'm quite aware that we haven't reached a conclusion on the issue of what to do about consumer trust, but I think that what I'd like to propose is that we continue with this presentation and the next agenda item, go through to meet the GAC, yes, and then revisit that issue when we've had the benefit of a few hours of it sort of working through our unconscious to decide how to progress on that issue. So, I'm not going to, you know, you tell me when you're ready, that's fine. And I'd just like to welcome again our observers this afternoon. Thank you for staying with us. James.
So we discussed this a little bit over lunch, but if I could make a suggestion that these presentations are very dense and a lot of detail, and they refer to a number of external documents. So if we could be allowed to run through each presentation, Kathy's and then mine, and hold questions until the end, and then we can go back and, I think, do a deeper dive into each one individually. I'm concerned that if we take questions as we go along, we'll burn up the entire afternoon and only get through about a third of what we're trying to relay to the group. So if that's acceptable to everyone, then I would suggest that's how we proceed.
I don't see any objections to that, James. I think that that's a very sensible suggestion, because quite often as well, in a slide deck, you'll be anticipating questions or questions will anticipate information that comes up. So if we can all try to keep to the discipline of holding on to our questions, just note them as the presentations go on, and then we'll have a discussion after that. So let's see how we do on that.
Alice is setting up, but she'll be driving the slides. But as a preface, and while the slides are coming up, I'll introduce myself. I'm Kathy Kleiman, Vice Chair of the WHOIS Review Team, but also Director of Policy for .org, the Public Interest Registry. And I'll be talking about registry, WHOIS obligations, and the GTLDs. By way of a little light reading, this has been what I've been doing, guys, the WHOIS Review Team, and every document I could find related to WHOIS policy and obligations and RFCs, and I'm happy to share it with whoever would like it. No takers, though. Okay. And we're still waiting for the slides to come up. But James and I will be sharing this presentation. We're both members of the WHOIS Review Team sub-team looking at the question of what is WHOIS policy. It's an obligation under the Affirmation of Commitments for us to look both at ICANN's WHOIS policy and its implementation. So our sub-team is looking at the policy And another sub-team will be looking at the implementation when we hand it off to them at the end of today's meeting. By way of further background, we're focusing today on the GTLDs. There will be a part of the discussion at the end, Madam Chair, will be to what extent and how would we like to look at the WHOA's obligations of the address organizations and of the CCTLDs. So with that said, I think we are ready to begin. Okay. Can we go back to the first slide? Right. So we're looking at ICANN WHOA's policy registry obligations. Thanks, Alice. Next slide. The registry obligations are laid out, and here I'm going to be using PIR as the example.org, are laid out in the appendix of the registry agreement. For us, it's Appendix 5. And it says it's called WHOA specifications. You can reach it on ICANN's website. If you go into quick links, all the registry agreements are available. And another question we'll be asking Madam Chair at the end is, to the extent that we'd like staff to take a look at how the principles that we're finding kind of universalize across all of the agreements. That would be just a good research project in and of itself. Okay. Next slide, please. Okay. Our obligation, in kind of summary, the registry operator's WHOA service is the authoritative WHOA service for all second-level internet domain names registered in the .org, top-level domain, and for all hosts registering using these names. So .org, we hold the definitive database on the WHOA's data. Additional obligations, next slide, please, are that we'll be updating our WHOA service on a real-time basis, that we will provide results in ASCII for both standard and IDN.org domains. And as we've talked about here, the IDN issue itself is one up, but this is our agreement that we provide an ASCII result. And also, interestingly, provisions for the detection of abusive usage of registry operators' WHOA systems, such as excessive number of queries from one source, will be implemented, and that will implement countermeasures as needed against abuse. The WHOA service consists of two parts, and many of us are not familiar with both parts. Many of us use one or the other. It's a port 43 WHOA service and a web-based WHOA service. Next slide, please. I'll start with the one I think most of us are familiar with, the web-based service. And our registry obligation is to provide a link to our WHOA data at the registry website and also a link to every one of our accredited registrars. And that obligation is spelled out in our registrar agreement. Next slide, please. More interesting, perhaps, is the port 43. And it is, I actually had to do a little research. What is a port? These are assigned by the IANA, the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority. And what it does, if you're coming in on port 43, it accesses a set of built-in commands in the operating system that allow you to kind of simplify the processing and response to a query. It references a library of that knows what the query is and how to respond. All technical. Nope, back. Thanks. But basically what it is a text-based, human-readable query system. So it's accessed from the run line on your computer or from a bulk process. And if you want to play around with port 43, I can now show you how, thanks to James, I think, showing me. Okay, next slide. Now a deep dive. And here we're going to go into some technical material, but I think for the purposes of our review team, this may be useful because we're talking about this issue each and every day now. How do registries know what commands they must receive and how to format and provide their responses? Because this is really key to the essence of our registry obligation under the WHOA's requirements. The fact is that a lot of what we do is actually set out in a protocol by the Internet Engineering Task Force. And next slide, please. And I'm going to give you just a brief overview of the long story of the WHOA's protocols and the IETF. In 1982, Ken Herrenstein of SRI International wrote the first protocol on WHOIS. It was actually called RFC 812, titled Nickname/WHOIS. And it set up a protocol for a transaction-based query response server to provide a net-wide directory service to ARPANET users. And ARPANET was, of course, the first operational packet switch network, and it was part of the DARPA, a U.S. Department of Defense project, and would go on to become a good part of the Internet we know today. Next slide, please. Okay. In 1985, RFC 954 replaced RFC 812. And same name, but it set out a new series of commands for a text-based net-wide directory service to Internet users. And so now we're going to start talking about directory service, a set of commands and responses, the directory service that the WHOIS protocol creates. Next slide, please. In 2004, we didn't replace RFC 954, but we modified it with RFC 3912, not we, the IETF, and added, removed some information that was no longer applicable to the modern Internet. There's an interesting note in RFC 3912. It says, the WHOIS protocol has no provisions for strong security. WHOIS lacks mechanisms for access control, integrity, and confidentiality. Accordingly, WHOIS-based services should only be used for information which is non-sensitive and intended to be accessible to everyone. And that was actually called a security note in the RFC. Why do requests for comment matter? They matter because they formulate the way the system works, what commands the system recognizes, how the requester can delimit or format the responses, and the way the receiver of the request should respond. I say this because the vast majority of the registry obligations in Appendix 5 are very technical in nature. What commands people can issue and how we have to respond, what ways they can change and limit the answer to the search or expand it, and how we have to respond to those queries. It's fascinating. It's actually the vast majority of it is about the commands of a directory service that we have to provide. So, again, these RFCs are the basis of the directory service that we often refer to as WHOIS. But WHOIS has so many words, has so many uses. It's a protocol, it's a directory service, it's data that I'm trying to kind of get a little more rigorous in how we're using the term. So this is the directory service as a set of commands and responses. Okay, next slide, please. No, we haven't even talked about data yet. That's because the majority of the registry WHOIS requirements are technical. System specifications of a directory service type established by the RFC is what we just talked about. So all these slides, and we haven't gotten to data. Okay. So finally, the WHOIS data. The registry contract for .org sets out a domain record with sample fields that we have to provide and qualifies it with the fact that the registry operator will not be required to post WHOIS output fields that are not required for posting and the registrar accreditation agreement. Basically, we can't post data we don't have, and we get our data from the group that works directly with the registrants, which is the registrars. Okay, next slide, please. Here is sample output provided for the query whoisdomain.org, and this is actually used in our registry agreement. All these lines come from there. So you can see a domain ID, a uniquely assigned registry ID for a domain name, the domain name, the creation date, the last update, the sponsoring registrar, very, very important, the sponsoring registrar. Next slide. The status in terms of delete, renew, transfer, update, in this case all prohibited, a registrant ID, name servers, where are you going to find that domain name? And then, next slide, please, we get to all sorts of contact information, registrant name, organization, street, city, state, postal code, county, phone, email, with similar fields for administrative contact, technical contact, in some cases billing contact. And that slide is a duplicate, so we'll keep. So for us, for .org, we are a thick registry. We hold the authoritative, extensive set of domain data. We hold the master database. Registrars are also expected to display this data in their WHOIS services. This is as opposed to a thin registry. VeriSign negotiated a very different contract for .com and .net, and actually .org in 1999, but .org transferred to the Public Interest Registry on January 1st, 2003, and has a new contract since then. So right now, for what we're talking about is .com and .net as they exist today. So it was a brand new ICANN, and VeriSign negotiated a different contract for .com and .net. Next, and here is what VeriSign shows in their thin registry: the domain name, the registrar, the WHOIS server, referral URL, name servers, status, and update creation expiration dates. A very, very, a much more limited set of data. So it's the registrars for .com and .net that hold the more detailed identification fields for the registrants, for the administrative contacts, for the technical contacts, and my little plug for James that stay tuned for his presentation to follow. Okay. This is certainly a lot of information to share, and you know I'm pleased to have the opportunity to do it with both my peers on the review team and with you in the audience. So let me give a quick summary. Overall, registries are under directory service pursuant to the requirements of the RFCs on who is from the IETF. What data they access in that service depends on what data they hold under their contracts with ICANN. And of course, a review of the thin and thick registries, and a note that the new GTLDs are expected to be thick, where the registry will hold the data. That's what's been proposed in the applicant guidebooks. And a disclaimer that this is only GTLD WHOIS policy that I am presenting, and a note that we were looking forward to Wilfried coming back to share with us at some future time the IP address policy. And I'm so glad you've been able to join us now. And one of the questions we'll be asking the GAC and the CCNSO is for information that would be useful to us about the CCTLDs and their WHOIS policies. I'll just state a final requirement, since it's my job to tell you what the WHOIS policy is to registries, that we will provide bulk access to up-to-date data concerning domain names and name server registrations maintained by us if requested by ICANN. That's provision two. And that's about it. Questions are welcome. I'd also be happy to show you our registry agreement in detail.
Kathy, thank you very much. I think that's a lot of information for us to process. What I'd suggest, in line with James's opening, is that we hold questions.
Did you want to take a few now?
While we're setting up, go for it then.
I'm not sure. Maybe I can. Happy to wait till after James. I just had an observation was that that was really useful and a good level. It was really good. Just one thing I think that we noted from London was that this question about what WHOIS policy is. Mm-hmm. Like, I couldn't help but noticing that your presentation on WHOIS policy was all about technical standards and contracts with an apparent absence of anything that ICANN might call a consensus policy.
James will address the consensus policies. It's a very good question, as most of them are relevant to the registrars, but also that's how we split it up.
Okay, yep,
but
great.
You're absolutely right. The consensus policies are important there, and they're part of his presentation,
yep.
So thank you.
Cheers.
Wilfried?
Well, just for clarification, coming back to the slide that points into my direction, I'm definitely going to try to supply the information that is mentioned in this slide. But for formal reasons, I think everyone should be aware that the mandate for this review team is restricted to the domain name things, and it's restricted to the parties that are covered by RAA. So anything and everything that comes from the country code TLD environment plus the results registry is for informational purposes from my point of view, unless I have missed something that was going on over the last few weeks, because that's actually what's in the mandate for the RT4. Because the registries or the RARS databases or WHOIS services are not in any way or fashion under contract with ICANN or IANA. So this is definitely going to be interesting from a technical point of view, and I'm not objecting against having this included, but just for the parties who may be watching us from the outside, I think we have to make clear what the scope of the activity is. Thank you.
I think that's a very good point.
Thank you, and yes, just to clarify, the thinking in terms of looking at CCTLDs is exactly as you suggest, that it is not for anything other than information. Look, here is a similar service done across a number of other registries. They're not under contract to ICANN and not under any obligations from ICANN in this respect, but is there anything relevant here for us? James.
It's unclear what WHO is defined to be in the scope of ICANN. It might be possible that if we have more than 90% of domain WHO is questions, that it might be restricted to this, but it's currently unclear. It might be possible that we have policy decisions which have influence to other areas here, and it would be carelessly from us if we ignore them and make a decision saying 90% is enough, and then we have a lot of problems with the remaining points. CCTLDs tend to use existing structures and existing policies. The same goes for the address reporting organization. They are happy with a procedure they can rely on. Of course, they have their own decision-making process. They have their own consensus process. But if ICANN is doing some policy definition on WHO is services, this has a strong influence to the development and the process in other areas, even if we restrict ourselves. I do not see this from the AFC. If we restrict this to domain WHO is, we have to keep in mind that even in this case, it has a strong influence to the other WHO is services, if we like it or not.
Wilfried?
Technically, I agree. There is definitely going to be a back and forth of information, and we are not living in a vacuum, none of our organizations. But still, I'm holding this as important. We have to make it clear what the formal requirements of this team are. Just the fact that I'm sitting here eventually next to Lutz on this table here is a sign that we are, of course, following up and contributing. But whatever we do on a formal level and a formal basis has to be not restricted, but focusing on the formal mandate of this review team.
Thank you. Those points are noted. I'm going to hand over to James now, and just a reminder to the team to please hold your questions. Let James go through his presentation, and then we'll have a discussion afterwards.
Thank you, Leslie, and I have about maybe 14 slides, so I'm sure that there will be at least something in there for everyone to throw sticks at. But I had this idea that I would have the PowerPoint slides on one screen and then the registrar accreditation on another screen. Unfortunately, that's not working. So if anyone would like to go to ICANN and do a search on registrar accreditation agreement and follow along, that would be great. Otherwise, I will certainly send out a copy after this, and we can continue to dissect this this topic as we go along. And I also wanted to compliment Kathy. Her presentation is very thorough. I try to just leave little short descriptors rather than read a contract back to a group. I think that that's something I'm trying to avoid, and I just want to get the conversation going, and then we can circle back and address the questions. Okay. So this is my take on the obligations for with respect to WHO is that are upheld by registrars. And as we can see, there are a few springs from which this these obligations, the river of promises that we make flow downhill to the registrars. The first and most important is the registrar accreditation agreement that we have with ICANN, and that's the RRA. In addition to that agreement, we sign individual contracts with each registry that we are accredited for that TLD, and those are registry registrar agreements, the RRA. And we have several. For example, we have one with PIR and also with country codes as well. Additionally, we have a number of ICANN consensus policies. And what this means is that the ICANN community has gotten together and developed a policy using that policy development mechanism. And upon acceptance by the GNSO Council and the board, that then becomes part of our contract. So this is the way that the RAA evolves and grows over time. And then I'm just going to touch on a little bit about compliance efforts, not to go into too much of a detail, but just to kind of give an overview of one particular system that is in place to assist ICANN compliance and assist registrars. Okay, so starting with the RAA, this is the Registrar Accreditation Agreement. There are actually two versions of the RAA. I don't know if that's always common knowledge. The RAA was amended in the summer of 2009, and while it's not an even distribution of the number of registrars that have moved over to the new agreement, it is true that the very large registrars, in terms of market share, have moved over. And so the net result is that about 90% of GTLD registrations are under the new version of the RAA. But it is a complexity that I think certainly ICANN compliance and perhaps this group should consider, is that there are multiple versions of the contract that governs registrar obligations. For the most part, our obligations for WHOIS are contained in Section 3. That's registrar obligations. And that's the section that's going to constitute the bulk of my slides. So we'll just go ahead and dive into that one next. So starting, and again, I just kind of went through each one and tried to tease out those that I felt had some relevance to WHOIS. It's very possible that I missed one. It's very possible that I grabbed one whose connection to WHOIS is a little sparse. We'll flesh that out as we go along. But this, in my opinion, these are the provisions that have some bearing on our WHOIS obligations. And the first one being, obviously, our RAA Section 331, registrars must provide interactive web and Port 43 WHOIS systems. And the data elements are defined further in that section. So that's domain name, creation date, expiration date, but then also the contact data for all of the different contacts. And then each contact element is also defined, so name, postal address, email address, telephone number, et cetera. Another one is that registrars must promptly update any changes to these data elements. So, for example, if a registrant says, I've moved, we don't have the discretion of saying, well, we'll put that in our next batch update, Tuesday, the 4th of August. We have to make that change as readily as possible. There's another section in there as well talking about the concept of a future centralized WHOIS system. Now, I'm including this for a couple of important reasons. One is that here's an example of something that's in the RAA that is not currently implemented. It's a placeholder, if you will, that if something like this were to come along and be developed through consensus policy, then it would be referenced here in our agreement. This is an idea for a centralized WHOIS system. I suppose it could conceivably include some WHOIS successor protocol that we would all have to contribute our data to this system so that it could take over the functions of WHOIS. That comes back later, by the way, so that's the reason I included here. Oh, that is impossible to read. Section 335 essentially says that registrars must include terms and conditions for not only submission of queries, but also how the responses can be used. And I went ahead and threw our example up there. Paraphrasing, it says something like the registrar makes no guarantees the accuracy or completeness of the WHOIS data. It is, to the best of our knowledge, reliable data, but it's not something that we warranty. And then the third paragraph, I think, is what you guarantee to us, that you're not a spammer, mass marketer, and you're getting this information solely to research the information behind a domain name, and you're not harvesting this information. So this is just some terms and conditions that by submitting a WHOIS query, you're essentially agreeing to some of the restrictions on its use. This is an interesting provision. It's Section 336, which is that says under certain circumstances, Registrars will provide third-party bulk access to the WHOIS data. The circumstances are kind of lengthy, and they're spelled out further along in that section, but they essentially describe what types of uses and what types of situations that should be granted. My reading is that that is an indication that registrars have to do some due diligence when receiving these requests on whether or not the requester meets the criteria that is further outlined in 336, is whether or not they are allowed to do that and to have that data. Section 337 is also interesting in that it talks about the conditions under which Section 336 goes away. And it's that we are can be replaced by consensus policy, number one, or I think number two is that we have to demonstrate to the satisfaction of ICANN that there is no monopoly or market player in the domain name space that has market power, and therefore it's no longer necessary. If we were to successfully do that, then Section 336 evaporates in a puff of logic. There's an interesting provision below that, Section 338, which we call a trapdoor, which essentially says that if it's something in response to changing statutes or regulations, ICANN can create new policies governing our use of WHOIS data. And so I think our interpretation of this is that it's a placeholder, again, for ICANN to very quickly make changes to the RAA in the event that the regulatory environment shifts significantly under our feet. And I wanted to make a special note of that section to the applicable law subteam, because I think that that's something that they should probably be aware of is in the RAA. And there's a corresponding policy or procedure outside of the RAA, and we'll get to that at the very end. A couple more here. Section 341 describes the database that we're supposed to operate and includes all the different fields. It's interesting that it also acknowledges that there are privacy and proxy services in this world and describes what the procedures or what our options are for escrowing that data. Section 342 through 344 outline some data retention and data inspection provisions. Gives ICANN the right to request our data and that we have to provide it in a certain timely manner, et cetera. We have to hold on to it for 3 years, although I think especially in the case of U.S. registrars, the 3 years wouldn't cut it for some of our requirements. I think we most of us exceed that by a long shot. Section 3.5, I spent about an hour in the airport on the telephone with our legal folks unraveling that, but the bottom line with Section 3.5 is that registrars do not have exclusive rights or ownership to the data that's in WHOIS. It's a very convoluted provision, and I know that we have some legal minds on the panel and in the audience, and would certainly love to bring more minds to bear on this, but because it says at the beginning, effectively, registrars do not own the data that's in WHOIS, and then it goes on and on and on for a while. And at the very end, it says when a transfer occurs, that the registrar acknowledges that the new registrar has ownership. So, help me there. Somebody, the registration is created, it has zero ownerships, and then upon transfer, it has two. I can't quite figure that one out. Maybe that's not what it's saying, and I'm just misreading it, but, anybody who wants to take a swing at that, be my guest. So, I think that the point of including that is, when we talk about definitions of data processors, data maintainers, who's the producer, I think that's key. And it also, I think, is exemplary that the RAA is not a perfect document. It was written by humans and amended by humans. I'm sure that there were a few lawyerly humans involved in that as well. So, I mean, it's got some interesting quirks about it that we need to be mindful of. Section 3.6 is a data escrow requirement. I don't know if you're aware, but registrars are required to deposit that data with a data escrow provider. They can use the one that ICANN has recommended, Iron Mountain, or they can choose one at their own expense. This is to facilitate transfers of registrant data in the event that a registrar fails. We can move that over to a successor registrar and provide some continuity to the registrants that that were affected by that. Section 3.6, a very long section that describes business dealings with third parties, but also including registrants. You know, I think that there's a few things here. One is, for example, Section 3... I got an extra 7 in there, sorry. Section 371 through 372 discusses that the registrant must provide the registrar with accurate data. The registrant is on the hook here and can lose their domain name either through cancellation or suspension if they knowingly provide false or invalid data. So I think the point that we're trying to, I'm trying to emphasize with the inclusion of this is that you know, that the registrar is really looking to the registrant. They have a significant burden in ensuring that that information is correct, complete, and valid, and that if they are not providing that, that they are in breach. Section 3774 doesn't say that registrars have to have a privacy policy, but they basically give you the recipe step-by-step on how to build one. That's, I think, was touched on earlier. What data are we collecting? What are we doing with it? Who are we disclosing it to? How, I think for European law, how registrants can correct errors or omissions in the data that they've provided to us. So, you know, I think it just goes through, and I included a copy of our privacy policy just for reference, but I'm not going to hit you with that five-point font this time. Here's another area where it's kind of a placeholder for future policy development. There's a registrar verification and re-verification of registrant data. I'm putting that there. I think, Bill, you brought this up in London as to something that was in the RAA, and I think you referenced this a couple of different times, but I note that, that like the other one, it does say that if a policy is established in accordance with Section 4 of this agreement. So it's there, but it's kind of treading water right now, waiting for the community to decide whether or not it wants to act upon it. Section 312.2 is new in this version of the RAA and explicitly mentions resellers. I don't want to dig into that a little too deeply, and I can certainly have a longer conversation with Susan offline, but essentially it says that registrars are on the hook for what their resellers are doing, that any element of this or obligation of this agreement and any consensus policies that come up, you know, you don't kick that can down the road to your resellers. You are, you're responsible for doing that. It also says things like the reseller cannot pretend that it's a registrar or display the ICANN logo. If you ask a reseller if they're a reseller, they have to tell you yes and who their sponsoring registrar is. The point being that ICANN has no contract with resellers, but this section in the RAA, in some respects, is kind of an arm's length means for ICANN to govern resellers via the RAA of the sponsoring registrar, if that made any sense. Okay. So that was Section 3. Section 4 talks about the policy development process and what things are in scope and out of scope and going through various things. And then you get through the end of the agreement where it's got, you know, the things in all caps. It talks about jurisdiction and renewability and who can terminate and who can't or whatever, and there's all kinds of stuff in there that I normally skip over on my way to checking an I agree box. But there is this part here that says Section 5.8, ICANN has the right to request, and I'm paraphrasing here, personal data. They have to tell us why they need it, and then we have to give it to them, and then they have to use it in the way that they said they would. It doesn't anywhere in there say that we have the right to tell them no or that we have the right to really do anything except just essentially produce the data that they're requesting. So, I'm not sure exactly what all the downstream ramifications of that section is, but it did include some things about personal data, and so I thought it definitely needed to be thrown into this discussion. So that's, I mean, that's just a real high-level buzzing the cornfields of what's in the RAA mentions of who is. There's probably a few more. There's probably something that doesn't specifically mention who is, but has been applied to it either through, you know, different things. But can I finish, Stacey, and then we'll go through? Is there a big one that I'm missing? Is there an elephant? Okay, what is it? Yeah. Where? Yeah, that was. But that's in accordance with Section 4, correct? This is what we're trying to avoid. Yeah, it was in an earlier one. I had a couple of duplicate slides that I took out, unfortunately. I've never heard you say that about me before. Thank you. And I think there's something else in here, too. It's not necessarily a registrant data, but something about, you know, you have 15 days to cure upon notification or something like that. But we can dig some more things out of there as well. But anyway, that's Section 3. I wanted to give a couple of other big, you know, huge examples of where our obligations and who has come from. Because while the RAA is the largest, it by no means has a monopoly on telling registrars what to do. And the next big one in the food chain is the agreements that we sign with the various registries, including country codes, by the way. You know, we mentioned talking with the CCNSO. You know, we offer, I think, over 70 country codes, so we can maybe provide some different expertise or experiences in that area as well. But for each TLD that a registrar wants to offer, they have to enter into an agreement with the sponsoring registry. The registry may add or layer on their own WHOIS policies and procedures and specifications on top of what's already existing in the generic RAA. A really good example of this are the sponsored TLDs. So .asia, .tel, .museum, .xxx, if it ever happens, you know, those kinds of things. And what they often do is they require that we collect additional contact data to demonstrate that the registrant is an eligible member of the community that the TLD is positioned to serve. So I put an example there of .asia. I was on the elevator with Edmund, but I don't see him in the room. But .asia requires us to collect information on what's called a community eligible administrative contact, or CAE, which is the person or entity that is holding up their postal address as within one of the qualifying countries so that they can have a registration in .asia. There's lots of little things like this, and you have to be very careful when you're signing on new GTLDs and CCTLDs that you don't necessarily try to fit everything into the same bucket, because what you'll find is quickly is that experience gained in one doesn't readily translate to the next one. You really do have to reinvent the wheel each time along. Okay, there are also a number of consensus policies, and one, I would call it a procedure, but it's not a consensus policy, but we can talk about that as well. These are things that have gone through the policy development process over the years, been approved by the GNSO Council and the ICANN board, and have been implemented by ICANN staff and are now part of our contract and part of our obligations. A lot of consensus policies reference WHOIS data in their definitional work. Like, for example, UDRP you know, uses the WHOIS data to determine who should be responding to UDRP. Transfer policy uses WHOIS data to define who the authorized transfer contact is. But there's a couple that touch on WHOIS directly. One is the WHOIS Data Reminder Policy, WDRP, one of our favorites, right, Stace? Yeah, which essentially says that registrars are required to send an annual notice to every registrant to come in, review their WHOIS contact information, and, if necessary, update it. Pretty simple, huh? I mean, that's probably would be held up as the poster child for the most well-meaning and easily implementable policy that you could come up with in ICANN. Unfortunately, in the real world, it doesn't work that way at all. What we find is that the response rate on those is very low. They are caught in spam filters. They are thrown out. They are ignored. We have brainstormed internally with other registrars and with ICANN and ways to, you know, help increase that response rate. Sometimes we have even tried to put special offers in there. If you do this, you know, we'll give you some discount. We're trying to incentivize people to respond to these. And, of course, that generates, you know, we're turning you in. You're a spammer now. You're not following the prescribed protocol. So, you know, I think I'm putting this out there as, you know, everything, I think you can condense it into some very good ideas that there's still a gap, you know, in terms of the intention and the practice. And in practice, it's very challenging to get registrants to come in on an annual basis, review their information, and make corrections. We can bribe, we can cajole, we can threaten, we can beg, but only a certain percentage are actually going to take take action. There's a who is marketing restriction policy. I didn't really want to spend too much time on that because that was affecting the old version of the RAA, and it's now baked into the new version of the RAA, but it essentially restricts how WHOIS data can be used for marketing. I think answer is it can't. There is a WHOIS conflicts with privacy law. This is not necessarily a policy, but a procedure by which registrars can say, okay, the parliament of my country has changed their privacy laws. I'm now concerned that I'm in, my RAA is now in violation of local privacy laws, and then they can, there's a procedure they can enact with ICANN to go through that, to reconcile those two. There's a restored names accuracy policy, which discusses how a name is to be treated once it's redeemed from the registry in the redemption grace period, and that's a lot of stuff. But basically it says if you delete a name and then you go and undo that and want it back, you've got to put it back a certain way. And then I wanted to talk about one other one, and this is, I can't believe I left that out because it does talk about the WHOIS data problem reporting system, and I think this is what Stacey was alluding to earlier, which is that we have to respond to any claims that a name does not contain accurate or complete WHOIS data. And there's a system that's operated by ICANN that collects those complaints and then I believe categorizes them by the registrar that is sponsoring them, and then asks us to investigate. There's again some issues with this as well, and you know, I think that there's issues or concerns about whether this is meeting its intended goal. I think the intended goal was to keep the information in WHOIS accurate, and to allow people to report if someone wasn't, so that spammers and bad people couldn't hide behind inaccurate data. Well, we also see that a lot of domain investors will use this to kind of shake the trees and see if any valuable names fall. You know, I think it's another example of where there's a gap necessarily between the intention of a policy and how it's being used or possibly in that case misused in the real world. So I think that's the end of the slide deck. I wanted to just kind of close by saying that registrars have a lot of information about their customers. A small subset of that is WHOIS information. Okay, we have information that is beyond WHOIS. In some respects, we are simply collecting and passing along information and believing that it is correct and accurate because it has to be, or the other party is acting in bad faith. In some cases, we are taking action. In some cases, if it's a credit card number, we're taking very rapid action. But we have responsibilities to collecting data. We have responsibilities to make that data available. And we have responsibilities to protect those who would misuse that data. And it's the balance of all of those interests and all of those needs that makes this very challenging for us. You know, I think that I've only been doing this for about 4 years now. And I'm just very wary of anyone who walks into a meeting or a PDP with a kind of a silver bullet solution to the who is issue, because the answer is it's like the person who's balancing all the plates at the circus. You know, you're trying to keep them all up in the air, but you don't want anyone to really add more plates. And that's kind of the tightrope that we're walking with our obligations with who is. Again, you know, and one final concern is that we are commercial entities, and we have competitors. They would like to take our customers, so we have to come up with new ways to service them and keep them interested in keeping their business with us, and not going to some place where they think that, for example, their data might be better protected. That's something I think that Kathy probably doesn't encounter quite the exact same thing in a registry that has exclusivity. So. That's my presentation. Happy to take questions.
James and Kathy, on behalf of the team, I'd like to thank you both for a tour de force. I think that was really, really helpful. Just the file that you held up at the beginning, Kathy, which shows what an awful lot of information you have managed to fill it and present to us in relatively simple terms. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of questions. I see Lutz already with his hands up. What I've taken away from this, you know, this very valuable and generous sharing of information from you both is, first of all, thank you for saying that lawyers can be human as well.
not the intention. It was
one
a little
doesn't
joke.
Hear it very often.
It was a little joke. That went over a long way.
It was great.
Yeah. But the complexity, the detail of it, the number of different places where all of these obligations are contained, the fact that they're in different documents, the number of contracts involved. One area which I think is highly, highly relevant to our work and perhaps echoes some of our work this morning is the gaps between the intent of the policy, which is often very, very sensible and very straightforward and very well-meaning, and how it's actually working out. That goes right to the heart of the AOC scope that's been given to us. How is the policy and its implementation meeting the requirements? And so some of the information that you gave in that presentation really chimed with me from that perspective. But obviously, I'm going to open up the floor here.
Can I just make a recommendation that while we, you know, we kind of break protocol a little bit here, and that we have ICANN compliance folks in the audience and ICANN who is policy folks kind of clustered over there talking amongst themselves. Talking about
it's not very nice.
Plotting my doom over there. Yeah. So the question is, I mean, can we include them perhaps in this discussion if that's possible? Because, I mean, I think that, you know, to say that I have exhausted all of our obligations, I'm sure they have another side to the ideas of what I see as challenges with some of the policies. So, I mean, I think if you guys can come up to the front or something like that, it would be great. Thanks.
Bill, did you want to come in on that?
Yeah, if we are on item 5 in the agenda, the ICANN staff and compliance is actually listed as participants. So I don't think we need to specially invite them.
We are on item 5, yes. Lutz, I have Peter. There's seats up here, guys. Anybody else want to come in with some questions? Lutz, go ahead.
The registrar accreditation agreement is only relevant for ICANN accredited registrars. We have a lot of registrars out there which are not ICANN accredited. So for the WHOIS question, it's interesting to see how the registries are on this behalf to be handle this case. And there's an interesting point in the registrar accreditation agreement, point 1.13. 1.13 says simply that the registry has to provide the WHOIS service, has to collect all the data and has to provide the WHOIS access to it. So we have already a WHOIS model in the existing agreement here. In the other case, if we are looking on the direct agreement, sponsoring agreements for top-level domains, we see that we have the similar requirements for them to provide a WHO service beside .com.net, which provides only a thin WHO services. But the interesting question is how to deal with the non-accredited registrars. What are the obligations of a registry to deal with such cases? What are the obligations of reseller chains? How can a registrar enforce that all of its resellers deal in the correct way? That's very interesting points, especially for me. We are currently in such a situation that a registrar was... the registrar had problems with ICANN, and now the procedure is clearly not what happens now. He wants to cut down his own reseller chains. I have a feeling that all these measurements about, or all these agreements about WHO services are very valid, but in the most cases, in the most real world cases, are unusable.
I think I heard several questions, so I'm going to try to echo them back before answering, and then can you stop me if I'm... No questions? Well, I think you... Well, maybe a clarification. You made some reference to registrars who are accredited, but not ICANN accredited. So I'm assuming you are speaking of ccTLD-only registrars. Okay, what other type of registrar can sell gTLDs if they're not ICANN accredited? Okay.
Okay.
Peter, you're in the queue.
I'm trying to pick which of my questions to ask.
I've got Sarmad in the queue as well. Shall we take Sarmad first, or do you want to...
I'll follow up one of Lutz's questions just to keep the ball rolling,
okay.
Which is about reseller chains. James mentioned that there's a provision in the RAA for some sort of arm's length type regulatory net to reach out to resellers. Just how arm's length are we talking, and is this useful in any practical sense or not?
Yeah, I think, and I'm probably using terms of art in a clumsy manner here because, you know, I was a business major, so. What it contains in the registrar accreditation agreement is a provision that if you have a reseller, you must have an agreement with that reseller. And if you have an agreement with that reseller, you must contain these elements. So in a way, it is via the registrar and its agreement with ICANN, it is ICANN passing down some inheritable provisions to resellers. So I don't know if that makes sense. I don't know if that qualifies as what, you know, the way I, if I characterized it accurately, but it is the idea that by incorporating required elements into the RAA, those elements are passed down into the reseller agreement. And then for, yeah, it's a kind of creating a food chain of accountability, if that makes sense.
So such a chain actually...
Yes, in section, for the new RAA in section 312, and we can go through that in detail, or I can post it to the list. But there are, I believe, 5 or 6 specific things that must appear. 312.1 through 312.6. Good guess. That must appear in the agreement between the registrar and its resellers.
Thank you. Peter, do you have any further questions or not?
Yes, I do. I don't want to steal the floor, though. But I guess one thing that occurs to me is that reading the AOC, it provides a sort of a high-level view of what ICANN's existing policy is. And I think we touched on this in London, or whether there's maybe some disconnect here. So, such existing policy requires that ICANN implement measures to maintain timely, unrestricted public access to accurate and complete WHO's information. So I heard out of your talk today, James, some provisions relating to accuracy. Just for my information, where is there anywhere something explicit about unrestricted access? Is that covered off somewhere in any of the contractual arrangements or policies?
That's a good question. There is section 3.3, which is titled Public Access to Data About Registered Names, which I think is where we want. Section 3.3.1, again, I just summarized with a few words, but it is several lines, and I think it's essentially, it says, free public query-based access to up-to-date information. So and that the information has to be updated at least daily, et cetera. Now, I would say that in the real world, registrars have interpreted that as we can provide that on a basis until we believe that maybe that is being abused and that the WHOIS system, the WHOIS data is being harvested, which is a very, very significant problem. So what we have done is we put in things like CAPTCHAs. You know, we have put in things such as rate limiting per IP address. We have put in a lot of different mechanisms, not all of which are public, to ensure that some of those things are not abused. I did learn something interesting from a member of Afilius yesterday, which is that the transition to IPv6 and carrier class NATing may mean that all of our efforts to guard WHOIS information from being harvested may have just gone out the window. So we have to watch that very carefully.
I'm not sure if Peter's done yet. Are you done with the question? I'm just keeping an eye on time at the moment. I think that this is a valuable discussion. I know that I've got Samad and Bill and Lynn on the list. I propose that we keep this going until 3 and then have a quick go at the shape of the report before we then go and meet with the GAC. Does that meet with approval? Yep. Go ahead.
Okay, so I'm not sure how to phrase this one, but I was intrigued to note that there was an explicit reference in the RAA to privacy proxy services, and I also noted that there was talk about a registrar privacy policy. I'm just wondering how existing privacy proxy services fit into that framework. Because I believe from London we talked about the fact that they weren't regulated. And I'm or not always regulated. I'm just wondering where they fit. Perhaps they fit in different places depending on the model. I'm just trying to.
Yeah. So it's probably a clumsy insertion in the new RAA or a brilliant compromise, however you want to look at it. But essentially, the problem was this. There was no acknowledgement that privacy and proxy services exist either in an ICANN-endorsed fashion or whatever. But they are out there. They're the choice of a large number. I think 18 to 20% of registrants opt for some form of privacy service. So when the data escrow program was put into place, it raised an interesting question, which is whose data are we depositing in escrow? The actual customer, or what we call the underlying customer of the privacy and proxy service, if the privacy and proxy service is the registrant, or the privacy and proxy services contact information. And I think that there was a lot of discussion around this that I wasn't privy to, but what we ended up with was an optional or a provision that gave options. It said you will either expose the underlying customer information in your WHOIS, your data escrow deposit, or you will declare to customers of that service that their data is not escrowed and they are not protected from registrar failure from a failure of a registrar. It's kind of they're giving. Because there's so many different ways to implement privacy and proxy services. And by the way, they're not all affiliated with registrars. There's some out there operating completely independently that have no, whatever. So so I think that was the way they addressed that paradox. I can tell you that from our own perspective, I think it's understood that we are not making that declaration. Therefore, we are our affiliated services submitting its customer data. If that makes any sense.
Repeat the question just so I answer it correctly.
Well, let me put it a slightly different way. I perhaps see a tension between the requirement in the ASC that there be full, unrestricted public access to accurate data, and on the other hand, we've got privacy policies in reference to privacy proxy services. Now, this is obviously a key balancing act between having a public WHOIS system and privacy requirements. But in terms of the existing, what we're dealing with in terms of existing policy and documents, I'm wondering how that tension is played out in the existing framework that we've inherited.
So
are they allowed under, and if so, how, and is that a tension with the AOC type stuff?
Just because someone is using a privacy or proxy service doesn't mean there's not accurate information in the WHOIS contact details about that privacy or proxy service. And so if I were registering a domain name and I wanted to use a proxy service, of course that means I don't want my real name revealed. However, the privacy service or proxy service has to give accurate contact details so that someone attempting to contact the privacy service about a claim, they need to be able to contact that privacy service. And then there are provisions in the RAA section 3.773 that require the registered name holder, be it a privacy or proxy service or anyone else, to either accept responsibility or liability if there's a problem with that domain name or reveal the underlying person who's using the domain name. 3.773.
And that provision is also not without some controversy. So if you were in Cartagena, that was quite a feisty discussion.
Liz Gaster wants to come in on that too.
I just want to note that there is a difference, a legal difference between a proxy service and a privacy service. We tend to use those terms interchangeably, but when we talk about the registered name holder here, it might be relevant to be clear about the distinction. In the case of a privacy service and the use of a privacy service, if I, Liz Gaster, were using a privacy service, my name, Liz Gaster, would still be there as the registered name holder. But the information about how to reach me would be the privacy service entity that's providing the service for me. So I'm still the registered name holder, and people can reach me through the privacy service. The distinction between that and a proxy service is where the proxy is the registrant, is the registered name holder, and the proxy service has essentially licensed the name to a third party, but they are the registrant of record in WHOIS.
A privacy service or a proxy service, the information in the WHOIS data should be correct.
And if I could add just another point of information for you, in October of 2009, ICANN staff sent a letter to the GNSO and their newly formed RA working group that really focused on the sort of disconnect between community expectations and the actual enforceable sort of tools and mechanisms that ICANN has to enforce various provisions of the RAA. And that was followed up with very detailed staff notes that laid out some specific areas where ICANN compliance office was finding it difficult or challenges in enforcing and responding to community demands, and offered some various ideas and suggestions of potential remedies for the GNSO RA working group to consider. And I mention this specifically because privacy and proxy services and some of the issues surrounding that was addressed in these documents. So when you have time, you may want to look at those for some additional information. And Liz can give you more details on how the GNSO's RA working group has evolved in its work.
Thank you, Denise. Salmed, can I come to you next? You wanted to ask some questions. I've got a list, which is Salmed, Bill, Lynn. Lutz, do you want to come in as well? And then if there's any time remaining, Peter, we'll come back for any remaining questions. Okay.
Point of information. I don't have a microphone, so I'll just get it. Would it be possible for those people who've just joined us to tell everyone who they are, just very briefly? Stacy, can I?
Stacy Burnett, ICANN's Compliance Department.
Liz Gaster with ICANN's Policy Department.
Denise Michelle, ICANN.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Salmed,
I don't have a question anymore.
Bill?
So, first comment, both of the presentations, and I apologize for not being present for the first one. I had something else that I had to do at that time. But in looking through Kathy's slides, they were very complete. James, I was here for yours, and I think it was a very complete presentation. Question I have is on the agenda, and I didn't see in any of the material, really, from what documents is the who is policy derived? I would like I want a definitive list, so that's, yes, Kathy, there were some mentions of in your slides, but it's not, in my opinion, a definitive list, or it wasn't presented as such, and if it was, I apologize for not being here. I've heard several times that the RAA is not part of policy, but I will submit that if it is not part of the policy, then it is extremely confusing to me to understand why the GNSO, which is a policy-making body, has work groups and has had work groups, and the IP constituency and lots of other folks spend so much time on a legal contract when, in fact, what they care about is policy.
And I think, just to take a swing at a response, that what we need to look at within the RAA is Section 4, which essentially stipulates that there are, there are policies. Policies can be created, and the registrar, upon accreditation, agrees in advance, sight unseen, to comply with those policies upon their creation. So now we get to participate in that development process, but we are agreeing to them in advance, I think is one way to say it. As far as your original question, I think the first slide I had at least from a GTLD perspective, a fairly comprehensive list from our perspective of where our obligations come from, and that is the RAA, ICANN consensus policies, the various agreements we have with registries, and then local law. Go ahead.
Sure. But James, you have been the one who has repeatedly said the RAA is not policy. So on the one hand, you argue that it is not policy, yet in your presentation, then you say it is. So as an interested observer and participant, right, I need to know which one it is. It can't be both.
Okay. And what I'm trying to say is that it's a subtle and abstract point, and it's probably not coming out of my mouth properly, but what I'm trying to get across is that the RAA is where our obligations live, including our obligations to abide by consensus policy. So the RAA is, in and of itself, it's not a policy. I mean, we can call it meta policy, or we can come up with a different name for it, but it essentially is the contract that we sign that says we will agree with ICANN policy. Now, in it, it has a number of provisions that kind of set the playing field, set the rules and the boundaries, if you will, and then, it has this open-ended provision that says, new policies will come down the pipe, and you will accept them as if, they are as if they were a part of this contract. So I would welcome any other thoughts on that if I'm not, you know, if my take on that is off base, but I think that that's at least my general understanding of the RAA can enforce policy but not be policy.
Should we go to Lynn first and then Bill, would you like to come?
Bill, I think my comments are actually in line with yours is that, you know, first let me thank Kathy and James both for your thorough work, and I think that was so useful to our group. What stood out to me is that even though there is a lot of evidence of who is policy and what the current policies are, there doesn't appear to be an actual formal document that states the intention and commitment of ICANN that we would normally consider to be the policy, and that this could be a possible recommendation of or part of our work is that since we have gathered all this documentation on what we believe the current policy to be, we could draft that out. So, for instance, the standard format in such a policy document, it would include elements like who the policy applies to. So the points that Wilfred and Lutz have made about CCTLDs or IP addressing, that can be captured in a formal policy statement as who it applies to. Also, normally a policy document would contain who's responsible for administering the policy, who's responsible for enforcing it. And so I think although we do have well-documented consensus policies, we have the contracts which are used as an enforcement of the policy. I mean, we have a lot of good information. We're just lacking that document. And I think it's very doable for our group since we have studied this. And it's consistent with what we're charged with to look at the effectiveness of the current implementation, because this is standing out as something that's lacking and it's not difficult to fix. I would just make one quick comment, too, that there has been a communication that came out 2 or 3 weeks ago asking for public comment on a policy development process, and that might be something of interest to the group, so I just mentioned that in passing.
Thank you very much, Lynn. I have on my list Bill, Susan, Peter. Anybody else? So, Bill, the floor is yours.
So I'd like to echo really what Lynn said. Okay, I struggle to find the policy. Okay. And have since we've started. I believe there are lots of pieces of information out there, and some of it actually, I think, seems to have to come out of the RAA or other agreements. Some of it actually, in my opinion, needs to come from the AOC, because there are statements in the AOC about what ICANN commits to with respect to who is policy, and there are board resolutions recognizing the AOC. Even if there isn't a board resolution saying this is the policy of this organization, there are resolutions saying we recognize the AOC, we applaud the work on the AOC, and we commit perpetually to this. So it's pretty clear that the board did in fact review that document, understands its import, right, and agrees to live by it. And their actions since that time have been very strongly in favor of the AOC. So I think there are words in the AOC that relate to who is policy, in my opinion, in the absence of a document like Lynn is talking about. And we haven't found that document yet.
Thank you very much, Bill. Susan?
In reading the RAA, the 6 times promptly is used in describing, the how something has to be corrected or disclosed. And I was wondering if it's not in the definitions in the agreement. I was wondering if maybe ICANN, someone from ICANN or someone who's negotiated one of these can describe or define promptly, because I personally, in my day-to-day life as, you know, domain manager, have an issue right there in not being able to define how soon something has to be either corrected or disclosed.
Before we move to Peter, does anybody want to respond on that question? James?
Well, I think that was directed at ICANN staff, but I'll just go ahead and jump in that, you know, in our particular case, because I like to pretend I'm ICANN staff sometimes, but in our particular case, it's probably measured in milliseconds. I don't know if that passes the promptly threshold. Now, in other registrars' cases, it may be minutes, hours. I would hope certainly not days. But I think that it allows for, it's a scaling question, in my opinion. It's a word that is, it's frustratingly ambiguous, but it's a scaling issue in that, you know, it allows for startup, mom-and-pop type of shop that's maybe a boutique registrar, and it allows for a very large global retail organization type as ourselves. So I think really what it's trying to do is cover all of those bases and probably failing at all of them, but, you know.
So within ICANN, we've recognized that this term has not been defined in the agreement, and we've talked about in any future amendments that particular term needs to be defined. But just a dictionary definition, it means act with haste. Doesn't mean sit on something. And so we plan to try to define that term going forward, but again, it means act with haste.
Just really quick. So would you say promptly is 7 days or 30 days or 6 months?
It certainly isn't 6 months. But, again, we haven't come out with a definitive definition. And if I were to tell you today it means 2 days, then people would say, well, where does it say that? And there would be all kind of challenges. So I can't say that with any degree of certainty today. Again, it's being considered within ICANN when we make future amendments to specifically define that term.
Okay. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Peter?
Look, there's still a lot of questions I'd love to ask. I'll go back to Bill's point, and I think it perhaps clarifies something that I said a couple of times earlier, that with my references to the what's in the AOC and how that's reflected in contracts and so on. So I guess one thing I would note now that this is we're a bit further down the conversation is that neither Cathy nor James's presentation referenced the AOC in terms of who is policy, or perhaps you did. I'm sorry.
No.
So I guess maybe that's a question we need to consider: is AOC in scope for our team? I mean, you guys answered my questions about how they fit, so perhaps it is. And I guess the other point I just wanted to go back again to what Bill was talking about, where the RAA fits in, and if it's policy and we don't have a definitive policy document, it would seem to me, and I'm happy to be corrected, that the RAA fits into implementation. But perhaps I'm wrong, policy and its implementation.
Cathy?
It's interesting. There was a discussion happening in another part of ICANN a few days ago on a different issue, but basically, it came down to the question of how long it takes something to percolate across contracts, because ICANN is a contract-driven organization. There was something that said, you know, this is an issue. So I just wanted to note the date on the affirmation of commitments, at least in the header that I see, is September 30th of 2009. The contract I was reading to you for .org is 2006. The most recent RAA that we were talking about was 2009, with an earlier version still out there. So it does take time for these things to percolate down into the contractual obligations that we have.
That's a good point. And I'll go ahead and be just even a little more difficult. We're not a signatory to the AOC. Okay, we can believe it's a great idea and a good document, but to implement the AOC, it has to go through something that we've signed, the RAA, through the consensus policy that's defined in Section 4. That's how the AOC comes to our front door and says, you are now an obligation. Okay, so, the AOC is a good document, like I think in principles, but until it's goes through the gauntlet that Kathleen described and kind of percolates through all the different contracts, it's not yet one of our obligations, unless we take it on voluntarily, which we do, by the way, and I think that the compliance folks will note that.
Thank you. I have Bill wanting to come in. Peter, do you want to come in? Okay.
Yeah. That, as a user of the Internet and someone who relies on things like the AOC, that's concerning to me. Okay? That says that I can, as an organization, commit to things and then can choose to ignore it. That's not an affirmation. That's not a covenant. Okay? I view the affirmation of commitments as a covenant, just like at prior companies when we would issue non-assert covenants on patents, they stand forever. Okay? So that's a concern. And I'd like to point out in Kathy's slides, if I could, page 6, top slide, the had an interesting security note. The top one on page 6, where it mentions that basically, and this is a standard thing in IETF RFCs under security considerations, it is a required component of every RFC. You cannot publish an RFC, to my knowledge, without a section entitled security considerations. The sentence that is missing, and it could simply be because of the way the RFC breaks, it uses old ASCII text. The piece that is missing from the quote under security considerations is the absence of such security, it's the last sentence, the absence of such security mechanisms means this protocol would not normally be acceptable to the IETF at the time of this writing. Okay, so when this RFC was written, which is merely to delete information and to make things clearer, okay, the IETF is saying we wouldn't normally allow this to be published this way. Okay. However, it has existed this way forever, and we're not changing it. So I think it's an important point that says, because the statements above say don't use this to with sensitive data, but it also is saying, but we have to use it because that's what's there.
Kathy, you wanted to respond?
I think that's very useful. And reading RFCs is an art, not a science. And I share with you my preliminary attempts at it. But I just wanted to talk about implementation timelines because there seems to be a sense that implementation is automatic. And I just wanted to share that in other places, you know, if Congress passes legislation across both houses and the president signs it or it goes into effect by virtue of the number of days in the United States, then it is the law of the land. However, if the United States signs onto a treaty, under our national laws, it has to be implemented by Congress. There is a timeline for implementation, even though we've signed onto the treaty. So here, I think it seems to me we're talking about timelines of implementation, and there are timelines, and that may be something we want to talk about. I'm not sure one can automatically yell breach, and I'm not sure that's what you're doing, but I just want to say timelines of implementation.
Anybody else want to come in? I've got Lutz. Did you want to come in on this point? Okay, yes, please.
See? Yeah, Bill, and I think that, you know, the short answer is that's why we're here, you know, to make sure that ICANN doesn't ignore its obligations under the AOC. That's what the review teams are for. So we're keeping them honest. You're keeping them honest. But, you know, I just looked, checked again, and it still says, Larry Strickling and Rod Beckstrom. So we're unfortunately, something in the AOC doesn't, you know, immediately, unless we voluntarily want it to become part of our practices.
Okay, I have Lutz, then Peter, and then Lynn. And just before we go to Lutz's question, I think you're going to like this, right? We're going to have these questions. Then I think we'll have a little break and make our way over to the GAC to start promptly at 3:30. Okay? I have no idea. Colonial Room, right. Okay, so follow Peter. He knows. He's been there. Right, so we'll grab a coffee after this. We'll do our bit with the GAC. And then what I'd like to do is, in fact, we covered off There are two more items on the agenda apart from the draft report. We actually covered off one of them in quite some detail this morning when we were talking about the way that we approach the other groups, and I think we're relatively sorted on that. And the sub-teams, I think we can do quite quickly, I hope. So what my proposal is that we go and do the GAC, then we come back here and have our last hour and a half, or probably a bit less than that, really trying to get to grips with the shape of the report, because I think if we can do that, I know that we haven't closed off every issue today, and in particular how we get to consumer trust, but I think from my perspective, if we know what we're aiming for and we've got some headings in the draft report, even if we can attempt that, I'm keenly aware that we haven't attempted that yet. So that's my proposal for the rest of the day. Does that suit? Just nod. Yeah, okay. Lutz, thank you.
Coming back to the question of privacy and proxy services, from the ICANN annual report in 2009, was defined as a lookup service to enable the internet operators and consumers to find each other and to communicate in a direct way. If we interest you or allowing proxy and privacy services, this goal vanishes. It's not possible to have direct communication anymore. So the question arises if whose services at all are currently needed, or if privacy services, the opportunity of privacy services, are simply a method to hide that we do not need whose services anymore and put a framework around to hide that we are providing a service we are do not need anymore. So the first question, the more important question is, in the 2009 report, or 2010 report for 2009, there are three proposed studies or consultations on who are services proposed by staff, and I'd like to know what was the outcome or the current state of it. First is a compilation of who is service requirements. Do we have such a compilation of who is service requirements after a year? Next one, proposed study on who is misuse on harmful purposes. Do we have something? Or who is registrant representation study? That's about is the registrant represented in the who is that in the correct way? There should be a study too. These three studies should have a state, or they are abandoned or on the way. I do not know. Would be interesting. Thanks.
I'm going to introduce Liz in just a second. I have an amazing, as part of my enormous binder, I have a most excellent report called An Inventory of Who is Service Requirements, Final Report, which I highly recommend and will send out the list to. So this is one thing that has been done. It's an excellent resource. It was very helpful to me and my research. And now I will pass it to Liz to talk about, because it sounds like you'd like to know about four studies now in discussion, debate, and progress within the GNSO Council.
So the GNSO Council asked staff to look at the feasibility of conducting four different studies.
The original wording on this proposal was we need a study on the expenses of making a study.
Right. That's right. The feasibility and costs, because we really had no idea what it would cost to do these studies. It was decided by the community that studies were important, that they needed a factual basis upon which to do further fact-finding and further policy work. There were important ideas that had been identified by the community about areas that were of concern, and a long list of them. Who is misuse is a good example. It's just a term that, means how much harvesting is going on of who is for nefarious purposes. And then a series of other kinds of proposals too, but quite a long list of them. And we really didn't have on the staff expertise to construct, you know, we're talking about empirical data here needing to be done by independent researchers on quite a variety of different tasks. So it's true. We spent a lot of time basically scoping whether these studies were feasible, drafting RFPs that we got consultation from the community on how the RFPs should be actually prepared, and I mean, in several cycles for all of these studies. And we published them, you know, in an RFP format so that it would be completely open and anyone could respond, which was very important, like not to do any kind of, you know, sole source or limited distribution. We sort of, you know, spread the net far and wide in terms of trying to find people who understand these issues who could help us. And we also had to do them serially, so it took a little while to do that. So where we are with the four studies... And I don't know, do we have a slide overhead? That I mean, I could pull up a slide if you want to see something specific on it.
I don't think we have much time.
Okay. So I think all of these reports and studies are referenced and linked on your yeah. wiki page. So if you
That's
go to the
right.
wiki page for background information, all of the, everything we've discussed here today
but
is on there.
But only two studies are done. One is the only two studies... One study is done, and one study has been agreed by the council to do. The one that's done is the WHOIS service requirement study that Kathy mentioned. The one that is where we're finalizing the contract this week, and we hope to just start the study pretty much immediately, is this WHOIS misuse study. And as soon as we get the contract signed, I'll announce who the independent research entity is that's doing that work, and we'll be done. And then I just actually don't have the slides up, so that's my problem. Don't plug it in.
Okay. You've got to go to the slides. Yeah.
And thank you, Wilfred. And then the last three studies I can talk in more detail about, but the bottom line is that all the staff research has finally been completed on those three other studies, and it's up to the council now to make decisions about whether which of those three studies, all of those three studies, none of those three studies should actually be complete.
With your permission, and Peter, Lynn, I'm going to suggest that we break now. Is that okay? We're going to break now, and then at 3:30 we're going to be interacting with the GAC for half an hour. So we're going to be back here at 4:15, and we'll carry on until 6. So
but we can't
you.
Be late for that. So we're
no,
gonna,
we can't.
And just a note, I don't believe the room is secure, so maybe take your things.